Mis- and disinformation is hitting hard during this election, and Latino voters are a big target.
It's not just spread by bad actors. It's sadly also spread by regular people just like you and me.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today in the Takeaway for Thursday, October 29th, a lot of real information about misinformation. Plus, President Trump is attempting to reach out to Black male voters, and we'll assess if it's working.
It's worth remembering that Trump, before his presidency, Trump was in a zillion and one rap songs. I mean, he was that person who was looked upon as, here's the epitome of wealth and success in America.
And what the recent SCOTUS rulings in some battleground states mean for this election. Then we'll round out the show talking Charlie Brown. He and our beloved Peanuts characters are heading to a paid streaming service, and their fans are not pleased. But first, on Wednesday, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg testified in front of the Senate Commerce Committee, where he addressed the spread of misinformation on his platform.
This is an extraordinary election, and we've updated our policies to reflect that. We're showing people reliable information about voting and results, and we've strengthened our ads and misinformation policies.
Both Facebook and Twitter say they've taken steps in 2020 to slow the spread of false information, including articles and ads meant to deceive voters. This week, Twitter rolled out a policy that involves adding messages about voting and election results to the top of users' feeds, as opposed to just debunking information that's already been spread. But misinformation is still rampant on social media. Signal Labs, a company that tracks misinformation online, found that in 2020, one out of every five vote-by-mail-related claims shared on sites including Facebook, Twitter, and Reddit was misinformation. And a recent study from researchers at Harvard found that President Trump was one of the main drivers of misinformation related to voting by mail this year. Here on The Takeaway, we continue to explore the truth gap in the United States. And today, it's all about how much social media companies or government officials can actually do to combat misleading information. Joining me now is Davey Alba, a reporter covering disinformation for The New York Times. Davey, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So let's start with the definition. Misinformation and disinformation, what's the difference?
Disinformation is misleading information that can be directly attributed to nefarious actors of whom we know the intent. That would be foreign influence campaigns like we saw with Russia in 2016 and other actors like that. Misinformation, on the other hand, is often referring to rumors that are circulating that may be false, but that actors who are spreading it don't know is false and is sort of taking those rumors in good faith and not knowing that they're spreading inaccurate information or wrong information.
What are some of the big topics that you're seeing are most at risk?
There are so many different flavors of rumors, but some of the claims that we're seeing include that Black Lives Matter protests are inciting violence at polling places and early election voting sites, that mail-in ballots are being dumped and shredded, and that ballot boxes and voting machines are themselves compromised. We've also seen a lot of claims of ballot harvesting, for instance, which is a loaded political term in which ballots are collected and dropped off in bulk by unauthorized people.
Who's behind a lot of this misinformation and disinformation? I mean, you mentioned briefly how the Russians sort of took advantage of Facebook back in 2016 to create, what they did was essentially create content that would stoke racial tensions, which many people say was a success. Who's behind it this time?
It's hard to pin down specific actors beyond Facebook and Twitter and the social media platforms themselves telling us who is behind a lot of this misinformation. What we can say is that the way it looks to most of us who are just on the receiving end of it is that it's a lot of outrage-inducing content and content that inflames our emotions. So it's stuff that includes social issues that Americans are already quite divided on, And it preys on those vulnerabilities and seeks to exploit that, essentially.
But we're not clear on who's doing it. Is that right? I mean, because a lot of political advertising and messaging can either come directly from the campaigns themselves or can come from things like super PACs or organizations, you know, outside of the campaigns who want to push a specific message. So we're not clear on whether or not it's those organizations or it could be foreign actors.
What we do know is that the levels of misinformation this year are almost unprecedented. It's on the rise and has grown since 2016.
Well, let me stop you there, Davey, because if the levels of misinformation are unprecedented, which we say a lot about this year, 2020, Facebook and Twitter have been aware of their role in creating this environment for misinformation. We just heard them Mark Zuckerberg and testifying yesterday in Congress. So what have they not done to prevent this spread? I mean, weren't they supposed to be taking care of this long before we are, you know, days ahead of the 2020 election?
Yeah, absolutely. And they have ramped up their policies to curb the spread of misinformation and have been acting more aggressively as the election nears. The problem is there's so many factors that come into play here, including that they don't want to be perceived as being biased or putting their thumb on the scale too aggressively. So, you know, in the hearing yesterday, we actually heard from a lot of Republican senators saying that Facebook and Twitter have, you know, liberal bias and allow liberal actors speech and posts to stay up while moderating conservatives' posts. What we do know is that that's largely anecdotal, the evidence that they cite. And, you know, there's been several studies that show that there isn't really a systematic bias of conservatives. And in fact, when we've tracked the top engaged posts on Facebook, which we do on a daily basis, you can start to see a trend where it's actually conservative speech that often rises to the top in terms of engagement.
I mean, at the end of the day, Twitter and Facebook are not in the business of removing these posts. They in fact, rarely remove posts. So how effective is it at the end of the day? I mean, I feel like these companies are, you know, sort of couching their own language to suggest that they don't want to be controllers of speech. But at the same time, they're not really doing that, right? And if what we're talking about isn't a political affiliation, but whether or not a post is actually factual or not, shouldn't they be responsible for this?
Yeah, absolutely. And they've, again, increasingly shown a willingness to moderate posts that are inaccurate.
Moderate, you know, how, though?
So Facebook applies a fact-checking label on untruthful posts, and they still really largely rely on their third-party fact-checking network to first come out with a fact check, and then they can label the post.
Davey, you know this. Facebook also said that they would limit political advertising in the lead up to Election Day. Now, we know the election season has already started, and Facebook makes a lot of money from political ads. So how has that been going so far?
The record on that is mixed. You know, with the misinformation policies and with this sort of silent period, which is just a week before the election, them not accepting new political ads, Facebook has been uneven on applying their policies. And, you know, they've never really done this before. So they are dealing with a new system, and we've seen some ads that were wrongly taken down or wrongly get through. And that's kind of been the story of the year, that they do have these policies, they're increasingly refining them, they try to adjust as needed, but that they still really operate a lot of times on a case-by-case basis. And when you zoom out and look at the enforcement of these policies, they are quite uneven.
Let's talk a little bit about other types of information that have come out in the lead up to the final election day. What about things like the Hunter Biden story that was published in the New York Post? Where does that fall into? Is that considered misinformation, disinformation, or just a smearing, for example? And we can look at it on the flip side. What about the Lincoln Project that put up a billboard in Times Square here in New York really upset Jared and Ivanka Trump to the point where they wanted to sue the Lincoln Project? I mean, is there a line between mis and disinformation and what's essentially could be construed as a mean ad or a smear campaign?
Yeah, and as much as possible, we should be trying to see who is putting up these various ads and posts. And that is what we can fall back on in terms of how to think about the actual content itself. So in the case of the New York Post story, it's a little too early to definitively say whether it's mis or disinformation, but the signs are all there that show that the circumstances of that story getting out were very suspicious. You know, we've been very wary of a hack and leak operation ever since 2016 when Hillary Clinton's campaign manager's emails were leaked on WikiLeaks and extensively covered by the media. And we've been trying to not repeat, you know, our mistakes from 4 years ago. And that's the kind of thing that alertness that should be incumbent on media and on all of us. So whether it's the New York Post story or this billboard, we should be trying to seek the sources of this information. And if it's not clear, we should be careful about resharing or taking them at face value. There's a lot of really good authoritative official sources. You know, you can get election information from your local officials, your county clerk, your government websites. And those are the kinds of sources that we should be relying on, the ones that are transparent about where they're coming from and giving and where they're getting their information. And with others, be more careful.
Davey Alba is a reporter covering disinformation for The New York Times. Davey, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And as part of our ongoing series about Latino voters called A Votar, we wanted to understand how false information has been spreading among this population in 2020. And it turns out that Latino voters, especially in battleground states like Florida, have been seeing a wave of mis and disinformation recently. Everything from unproven allegations of voter fraud to outlandish conspiracy theories tied to QAnon. And it's popping up in traditional media outlets like newspapers, local television and radio programs, but it's even more rampant on social media platforms like WhatsApp. Here to talk to us about all that is Daniela Costa Ramos, an investigative researcher at First Draft, a nonprofit that fights mis and disinformation online. Daniela, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
What are the biggest messages that we're seeing that are spreading within the Latino community in terms of mis and disinformation? Are there certain themes?
We have three messages that are spreading in the form of mis and disinformation. We have a campaign using the threat against socialism and communism, using common tropes that are misleading in context and in messaging. We have other initiatives that are meant to discredit vote-by-mail initiatives, affecting lots of Latinx communities. And last but not least, we have also promotion of racial tension between the Latinx and the Black community. Those are the three themes that we have seen the most affecting the Latino community while we're monitoring it.
Daniel, who is spreading these messages?
That's a really good question, because misinformation in social media blurs a lot of lines. We see how misinformation gets created within anonymous web that in the Latino community is mostly WhatsApp groups. We see that misinformation is created through that anonymous web and closed network spaces, and then goes to conspiracy communities and social media, and then ends up sometimes in our professional media. So mis and disinformation is not just spread by bad actors, people who are in this game with the sole purpose of spreading misinfo. Is sadly also spread by regular people just like you and me that receive a message and think it's worrisome and then share it with other people.
Are there specific demographics within the Latino population that are more susceptible to this type of information? There's been some reporting that I found slightly problematic that talks about how Latinos are obsessed with demonizing Black Lives Matter. And I think, well, are they, or is it a question of receiving false information and being more susceptible to those messages?
I will say, and this demographic is not exclusive to the Latinx community, but older people are more prone to share misinformation. The way they get information through Facebook, to WhatsApp, and then share it to friends and family. People, let's say, over 55, it's more susceptible to spread misinformation. And even though it's not unique to the Hispanic or Latino community, we see it a lot within that community in particular, that older people share more misinformation in their Facebook profiles, in their Facebook groups, in their Twitter handles. So it is worrisome that we have more people vulnerable.
What about language? What role does language play in both tracking this type of misinformation as well as spreading this type of misinformation?
Well, I'll tell you, when we started monitoring Latinx communities, we were expecting a lot of misinformation in Spanish. But after being monitoring for a while, we can say that most of the misinformation that we actually see is in English. And maybe that has to do with the fact that most Latinos actually speak English in this country, and that Spanish is meant to maybe older populations. That might be an answer, but that's usually the way it goes. And language also plays a part on how platforms fight against misinformation. We have seen in cases of banned content that YouTube and Facebook usually do a good job when it comes to banning content that is in English, but it's not that effective.
Is there anything that's being done now that this is essentially national news? I mean, this is something that's been reported on, you know, for a couple weeks now. Is there anything that's being done, Danielle, to prevent it?
Well, the platforms are, if we compare it with 2016, the platforms are way more aggressive, right? They're banning content, they are label and content, which is pretty important, but there's a lot of stuff to be done still. We have misinformation agents that are sharing problematic content in Facebook groups, they're sharing content in WhatsApp groups, they're sharing content in Twitter, they're sharing content in podcasts, they're sharing content in radio shows. So misinformation is not going away, and several institutions have to do their part. Governments have to do their part. Legislatures have to do their part. Civil society and nonprofits like First Draft are working to empower people to fight against misinformation.
What about Facebook and the social media platforms themselves, like WhatsApp? We're talking a lot about their role in trying to manage this type of misinformation.
Absolutely. You just feel short when you see the gigantic wave of misinformation that our community is getting. So the platforms needs to do more, all of them, from Facebook, that we have to remember Facebook is this giant company that not only owns Facebook, but Instagram and WhatsApp, which is particularly problematic in the spread of misinformation. And we have seen some measures, but I feel they're kind of timid. They're kind of small if you compare that to the problem.
Daniela Costa Ramos is an investigative researcher at the nonprofit First Draft. Daniela, thanks for joining me.
Always a pleasure.
In recent weeks leading up to the election, two hip-hop artists have indicated their support for President Trump. Well, sort of. Hip-hop artist 50 Cent announced his support for President Trump and encouraged fans to vote for him. But this week, he pulled his support for the president And Ice Cube admitted to helping the Trump administration connect with the black community, even as he clarified he is not supporting President Trump. And of course, we can't forget Kanye West's outspoken support for President Trump either. And although black voters are mostly siding with Biden, about 10% of black men say they're supporting President Trump. That's according to data from Pew Research. So here to help us break all of this down is Erica D. Smith, a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Erica, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
What was up with Ice Cube and 50 Cent? How did they align themselves with President Trump?
Yeah, it's kind of a weird story. Well, with Ice Cube, I mean, it was basically he earlier this year had released a contract with Black America, which is basically a plan for helping Black Americans get ahead and kind of combat some of the systemic racism that's been the topic of discussion this year. And so he's been floating this plan around, apparently, to different political parties, including to the Biden campaign and also to the Trump campaign. According to him, the Biden campaign basically told him that they would get back to him after the election, assuming that Biden didn't indeed win. The Trump campaign apparently showed more interest. And so he worked with them, though it's a little bit unclear as to what that working with looked like, but worked with them to kind of help them develop their so-called platinum plan, which is supposedly to achieve a similar goal, but there's a little bit of an overlap there. And so there's been a lot of hubbub about what Ice Cube actually did and did not do. Nonetheless, there's been some backlash about that. With 50 Cent, he came out on Instagram and said that he wanted to support Donald Trump basically because he did not like the Biden campaign's tax plan and that he'd be taxed so much. He since, as you mentioned, backed off of this. But, you know, nonetheless, it's caused some heartburn, I think, probably in the left among liberals about what Black men are willing to support as far as the Trump campaign is concerned as over Biden. So it's caused a little discussion within the Black American community about that.
I'm wondering, you know, this is an interesting thing because it's playing out also among Hispanic Latino voters and who support President Trump in larger percentages. But when you look at the gender breakdown, it's mostly men who are supporting men of color who are supporting the president. And here it's Black men, at least 10% of whom say they support President Trump. What is the scope of that support?
You know, it's really interesting as to why that's men versus women. I kind of tried to explore this in a recent column, but I think one of the reasons has to do with Biden himself. I mean, there's been a lot of backlash and back and forth over his involvement in the 1994 crime bill and how that widely is understood to be leading to the mass incarceration of Black and Latino men. I think there's also some backlash to Kamala Harris, his running mate, given that she was both a district attorney and attorney general here in California, and also, you know, oversaw it at a time when Black men were being disproportionately thrown in prison. And so I think there's some pushback because of the candidates there, not necessarily because of Democrats per se. That said, I think that men more than women, and this has been borne out in a number of studies, are less connected to the Democratic Party and less connected to the electoral process. And I think that basically all of the attention over this election has caused people to want to get more involved all of a sudden. But I think there's a sense of, for people who have been disconnected from the process for so long, that they don't really know how to do it. And I think that we're seeing what that looks like now with people coming in kind of at the 11th hour, trying to figure out what candidate to support and, you know, looking at the candidates kind of with fresh eyes as opposed to what's happened over the last 4 years in some ways.
You know, Erica, President Trump has, you know, while racial tensions in this country are at a fever pitch, the president has insisted that he has been the best thing to happen to Black voters in this country, which is, frankly, debatable. And yet 94% of Black women voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016. So why are Black men such an important target for the GOP?
You know, it's interesting. There's so many theories about that that have been floating around over the last couple of months. I mean, there's everything from, you know, it's Trump is appealing to this idea of what is a quote unquote strong man who can provide for his family, given, you know, Trump's history as, you know, a supposed wealthy man and billionaire who's a successful businessman. And that men and men of color in particular are drawn to that idea. I mean, it's worth remembering that Trump, before his presidency, Trump was in a zillion and one rap songs. I mean, he was that person who was looked upon as here's the epitome of wealth and success in America among the hip hop community. That's obviously changed, but you know that was a thing for a very long time. There's also been this speculation about this idea of toxic masculinity that, you know, that Black and Latino men for a long time because of systemic racism have been unable to provide for their families and unable to get ahead economically. Trump kind of represents this person who's been able to do it without following the major rules of society. So there's that idea. I think it's never really that simple. I mean, it's worth remembering that the vast majority of Black men are planning on voting for Biden, according to all of these polls. It's just that small percentage. And I think it's just basically just a lot of people, a lot of men, again, were not involved in the political process and are getting involved now and are basically trying to figure out how to do that. And I think that it's because of that, I think it's a little bit messy how this is going, how it's happening.
I want to end by talking a little bit about some other approaches to trying to get Black men to the polls. I'd like to talk a little bit about specifically how the Democratic Party is trying to appeal to Black men. I think there's a lot of feeling among Black women in particular that they're often taken for granted by the Democratic Party. But what about Black men?
Yeah, I think there's definitely that sense as well. I mean, I think Black Americans in general have felt that the Democratic Party has taken them for granted as voters. But I think men in particular, that has come up. I mean, you've seen, you know, in recent weeks, you've seen Obama go out and speaking to Black men specifically. You've seen after Biden named Kamala as his VP pick, you've seen her as a senator go out to various different events and trying to kind of smooth over and assure the activist coalitions of which many are Black men about what the Biden campaign or what the Biden administration would do to help Black people once in office in terms of police reform, in terms of other issues along those lines. So I think there's definitely a concerted effort to get Black men to vote for Democrats, but I think it's kind of late, and I think it should have happened earlier in the cycle, but I guess it's better late than never. But I still think the majority of Black Americans think that there really isn't much of a choice in this election, that it has to be Biden at this point.
Erica D. Smith is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Erica, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
More than 75 million Americans have already cast their vote for President of the United States, some by standing in line, early voting, and others by mail-in ballot. The United States Supreme Court has already decided three major voting cases this week alone, affecting the battleground states of Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina. Meanwhile, all this week, we've been hearing from you about how voting is going.
This is Stephen Trimble calling from Upper Providence, PA. We voted via absentee ballot in an official drop box. Our experience was incredibly easy. We filled out our ballots. My wife and I filled out our ballots, signed them correctly, put them in their secrecy envelope and then their outer envelope. And then we went to the drop box location, which was easily found. There was no line there. There were two poll workers there. And they instructed us how to insert the ballot into the drop box. We did so. They were out of stickers, so we didn't receive that, and we left.
Now, the stickers are important to a lot of folks. Joining me now to talk about the recent SCOTUS rulings is Jamie Floyd, the senior editor for the Race and Justice Unit here at WNYC and our resident Supreme Court expert. Jamie, welcome to the show.
Hello, Tanzina.
Let's start in Wisconsin, Jamie. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear a case that could have extended Wisconsin's deadline for receiving absentee ballots. What was the court's reasoning, and would you consider this a win for the Republicans?
Well, it's difficult to ascertain the court's reasoning because this was a brief unsigned order. And as is typical when they refuse to take up a case, the court gave no reasoning. The vote was 5-3. We can sort of glean some things. The court refused to take the case. That means they refused to revive the trial court ruling, which, as you say, Tanzina, would have extended Wisconsin's deadline for receiving ballots to 6 days after the election. So, yes, it's considered a victory for Republicans in a crucial swing state, which polls have shown Mr. Trump is trailing after winning by about 23,000 votes in 2016. And several justices, Tanzina, did file concurring and dissenting opinions that spanned 35 pages and revealed a stark divide in their views on voting during this pandemic.
This is interesting because we know that the Supreme Court, for a while under the Chief Justice Roberts, has had a pretty contentious relationship with voting cases. Before we get to that, I do want to talk about Pennsylvania. There were two decisions that came through yesterday. Pennsylvania, the Supreme Court has refused for a second time, this time the Republican Party's efforts to block an extension for counting absentee ballots in that state. So what did they do there? Feels like almost the opposite that happened in Wisconsin, is it?
That's right. It's a little bit of a tennis match, right? Going back and forth with your head pivoting each way in the land of the law. There, the U.S. Supreme Court also refusing to take the case. This is for a second time in Pennsylvania, the Republican Party trying to block a three-day extension for counting absentee ballots in Pennsylvania, another key state. They're leaving in place a decision by the state Supreme Court based on the state constitution that would have extended it by 3 days there, the period for counting absentee ballots past Election Day. Last week, the court upheld the state decision by a tie vote, with Chief Justice Roberts joining the three liberals on the court and later explaining that state courts are free to interpret their own state constitutions in voting cases.
And of course, the third state, also a critical state, a battleground state, North Carolina.
Yes.
What did the Supreme Court rule in that state?
It's essentially the same case as the Pennsylvania case, simply not coming up for a second bite at the apple, just the first bite at the apple. But again, refusing to block extensions. Republicans were trying to block extensions. So this one looks very much like the Pennsylvania case.
The Supreme Court also has a new member as of this week, Amy Coney Barrett, who did not participate in these rulings, however, or in these decisions, I should say. But she does mean her seating on the Supreme Court means that there is now a 6-person conservative majority, Jamie, as you know. What does that tell us for what we can expect after the election when it comes to voting rights cases?
Yeah, and indeed, the Pennsylvania, in that case, one of the counties had filed, but then withdrew a request for the new justice to recuse herself. But still, she didn't participate in any of these cases because she didn't get there quite in time for it. The arguments had been presented, and a statement by the court, in fact, said that she would not participate because they needed to promptly resolve the questions, given that the election is bearing down upon us. A rather unusual statement from the court. Not unusual that you wouldn't participate, just unusual that they issue these kinds of statements. But it is noteworthy, as you say, Tanzina, because we don't know what her vote might or might not have been, how it would have affected the outcome. And we do know that she most assuredly will get one of these cases in the coming days or in the immediate aftermath of the election.
Well, President Trump has indicated, Jamie, that the election should be called on Election Day. That's not something that's in the Constitution, but it does bring up concerns about and almost a shadow of Bush v. Gore,
right,
which was back in 2000. We're already expecting this election not to be called potentially on election night, even. Could SCOTUS play a role if there are concerns on Election Day?
It certainly could. Most troubling in the opinions you've cited, Tanzina, is a opinion written by Justice Kavanaugh in the Wisconsin case, where he attempts to cite Bush v. Gore as precedent. Every scholar recognizes that Bush v. Gore is not precedent. Even Justice Scalia, who wrote that opinion, did not see it as precedent. So that's troubling. But yes, the Supreme Court could play a key role. Tanzina, our system is supposed to be decided by the voters, not by the courts. So I leave you with the urgent plea, vote, vote like your whole life depends on it. That's the way democracy is supposed to work.
Thank you so much for that. Jamie Floyd is the senior editor for the Race and Justice Unit here at WNYC. Jamie, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And keep those early voting calls coming in. Give us a call with your experiences at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. For more more than 50 years, Linus, Charlie Brown, and the rest of Charles Schulz's Peanuts gang have been on TV at the end of October, searching for the mythical Great Pumpkin in their Halloween special, It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown.
Each year, the Great Pumpkin rises out of the pumpkin patch that he thinks is the most sincere. He's got to pick this one. He's got to. I don't see how a pumpkin patch could be more sincere than this one.
Well, unfortunately for Linus, finding the Great Pumpkin this Halloween is going to be a little harder. For the first time since its debut in 1966, It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown will not air on network television. Instead, it will be available on Apple's streaming service, Apple TV+. The classic cartoon will only be available to paid subscribers, though non-subscribers can watch for free from October 30th until November 1st. Peanuts fans are angry, and many worry that the gap between who can afford to pay for content and who can't will affect our collective experience of these classics. So far, an online petition calling for Apple to air the special on network television has already gotten more than 180,000 signatures. Joining me now to talk about all this is Alyssa Rosenberg, an opinion columnist covering culture at the Washington Post. Alyssa, thanks for talking to me.
Thanks for having me.
I love The Great Pumpkin. I'm just going to put it out there. I have an opinion about this. And before streaming and on demand, you know, I remember growing up with these shows and everybody would watch them at the same time and we'd have this kind of collective cultural experience. And what are the benefits of doing that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is real value, especially at a moment when kids are not having common in-person experiences, to making sure that they can have common cultural experiences and giving them the kind of language and references that will help them get back into the social swing of things when, and I don't even want to say it, if they're actually back in school and back in daycare again. And so I think there is something kind of depressing. It's, you know, it's a minor thing. It's a minor indignity. And yet having, you know, this beloved classic go behind a paywall is yet another indignity that 2020 has forced upon us. And I think for a lot of people, it just feels like a last straw.
It really does in a lot of ways. And I feel like, you know, and I'm wondering, is it just us who grew up with watching this and, you know, our kids today just really not? I mean, this is a pretty crude cartoon, you know, compared to what kids are used to seeing today. So is it just a nostalgia that, you know, boomers and Gen Xers and maybe older millennials have versus what kids are really interested in?
Is there anything wrong with wanting to share what you loved when you were growing up with your own kids? I don't think that's minor. I don't think that, you know, traditions are traditions, even if they're a little hokey or a little corny. So I think it's not necessarily even about kids. It's about getting to, parents getting to share with their children.
I mean, and there is a real another element to this, which is really talking about accessibility, right? There's the cultural connectivity that we all experience. But then there's the fact that, you know, if you're not a subscriber, you won't be able to watch this at your leisure. You won't be able to see it with everyone else. It won't be on national television. And what does that say about our media landscape today in terms of folks like Apple and others coming in and really taking these classics and putting them behind the paywall?
So I think it's worth remembering that this is not the first time that a bit of beloved children's content has gone behind a paywall. A couple of years ago, Sesame Workshop moved from PBS to HBO, in part because HBO could give them a larger series order. They could produce more episodes. And those episodes now have their first run on HBO, and they air on PBS several months later, once an exclusivity window has closed. And, you know, from a business perspective, this makes sense. You have all of these competing services starting up. They all want to be able to offer things that will be appealing to people of all ages because that makes them a better buy, right? I mean, if you're Disney, you have the Disney movies, you have Pixar, but you also have Marvel and Star Wars, so you have a sort of all ages offering. If you're HBO, your content has been primarily aimed at adults, and to a certain extent, I mean, it's nothing, no famous HBO original is appropriate for the Sesame Street set. Now, if you're Apple Plus, you know, that's a service that has spent an enormous amount of money, and we really don't know how it's doing. They've never released official subscribership numbers. They have extended their free trials for a long time.
Which is typical for Apple. They're not very transparent about their numbers. Neither is Netflix, right?
Absolutely. Well, Netflix at least releases subscriber numbers. We do have a clear sense of that. Apple has not done that. So there is a transparency gap there. But again, Apple needed, you know, wants something that is going to be an incentive to subscribe, an incentive to stay with the service once that once those trials are over. And so from a business perspective, it makes sense to try and snap up these legacy properties. But again, we have no idea how many people actually subscribe to Apple TV. And theoretically, the solution is that they're going to allow these specials to stream for free for 3 days every year around the relevant holidays. The problem is not everybody can stream content. I mean, Netflix has become so culturally ubiquitous that it's sort of easy to assume that everyone in the United States has an internet subscription, and not only has an internet subscription, but has broadband fast enough to stream this stuff
and has a phone and or a smart TV that they can watch it on, right?
And that's just absolutely not true. I mean, according to the 2019 American Community Survey, 13% of American households didn't have an internet subscription at all.
And Alyssa, we're really talking about poor kids and poor people and low-income folks. When you mentioned Sesame Street, I mean, I grew up watching Sesame Street partly because it was available to us. And this feels like it might be a small thing, but it really does point to those inequities.
Well, and it's not just economic. There's an urban and rural divide. I mean, there are places in America where even if you can afford broadband, you cannot get it because the service is not physically available where you live. And so, you know, something that is supposed to make life easier for consumers actually makes it more inaccessible and makes us culturally more fragmented. And that's a loss.
So when you have content that's spread over so many different streaming services, is it even possible to have a special like The Great Pumpkin Charlie Brown or movies like It's a Wonderful Life to become those cultural iconic touchstones anymore?
I think there will still be hits. Someday we will have movie theaters again. Broadcast television isn't dead, but anything that chips away at that cultural community really hurts, especially in a moment when we're physically separated from each other like this one.
I still find it very sad that we will not have The Great Pumpkin Charlie Brown on network television. Alyssa Rosenberg is an opinion columnist covering culture at The Washington Post. Alyssa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's it for us this week. Amy Walter is in tomorrow. And before I go, a quick shout out to the fabulous team that puts this show together. Our board operator is Vince Fairchild. Our director and sound designer is Jake Howitt. Jackie Martin is our line producer. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. The Takeaway's producers are Jose Olivares, Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, and Jason Tureski. Polly Arungu and Dina Syed Ahmed were our digital editors. David Gable is our executive assistant. And Lee Hill is the executive producer of The Takeaway. And you may have heard my 9-month-old co-host, Gabriel, will be watching the news all weekend with me and with you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.